This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, problems are accumulating everywhere, of course, because of the conflict in Ukraine, Putin's war on Ukraine, and there are other problems as well for the British government in particular, the economy, inflation at 10.5%, and as yet, the problems of Northern Ireland unresolved, despite the fact that the European President Ursula von der Leyen came to London, signed up with Rishi Sunak for the Windsor Framework, which is the latest attempt to settle the dispute about the Northern Protocol. That has been stuck, and I wonder what the European attitude to that is. There are also, of course, in Europe have been developments. Viktor Orban and Giorgia Meloni, the respective leaders of Hungary and Italy, have been shifting in their alliances. And we're joined now to discuss all of this by Suzanne Lynch. Suzanne is chief Brussels correspondent for Politico and the host of a very good podcast called EU Confidential. Suzanne, let's deal with the Windsor Framework first. Ursula von der Leyen flying to London, meeting the King, but more importantly, signing this agreement that's known as the Windsor Framework. For her to come to London, meet Rishi Sunak, sign the declaration, would that imply that the EU believed that this was a done deal?
I think it very much did, Eamon. I mean, there was a lot of pomp and ceremony associated with that visit over on the Eurostar by Ursula von der Leyen to England. And there was very much a sense that her presence there was suggesting this is signed, sealed and delivered. So already we're getting a sense that, you know, the EU has moved on here. Just last week, we had an EU summit where all the 27 leaders were gathered for 2 days, including the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. And, you know, nobody was really talking about the Windsor Framework. Nobody was talking about the UK. Now, the leaders did have to kind of give their assent earlier in the week, last week. There was a meeting of EU ministers and they had to kind of give the green light to two kind of procedural matters that have to be agreed at the EU level for the Windsor Framework to take effect. But this was always seen as quite technical and that there'd be no big pushback. And that's really what happened there. So the ministers kind of signed off on that, said that's fine. Effectively said they're happy with what Ursula von der Leyen agreed and are ready to move on. So now what you're hearing here is a lot about, I was just at an event this week where there was talk about, you know, maybe a new chapter for Britain-EU relations in the sense that we've already seen some cooperation on Ukraine. But also on the issues like sanctions and all those bigger geopolitical issues, they're hoping now that this can kind of unlock a bit of that. Although there was a cancellation of the King's trip to Paris this week because of the strike. So that didn't happen in the end.
No, but the question is, the DUP are the ones holding this up. Mm. Sunak has managed to confront his own European research group, hardline backbench Brexiteers. Successfully, really. despite Boris Johnson supporting them. The problem is delivery, and the problem remains the DUP. Is Europe's patience endless on this matter? Because it seems to me that they gave away rather a lot in the negotiations in terms of the jurisdiction of the European Court, for example.
No, you're right in that, like, part of the trick of this was that both sides could kind of claim victory. And I think it's in the EU's interest that, as I said there, you know, it just kind of gets passed here. There's not big scrutiny of it. Everyone says, great, it's finished. We're happy with it. But if there's a situation now, which is now likely, obviously, because the DUP is not backing this, that the whole thing now is up for discussion again, I think that's dangerous ground, because then you're going to get more scrutiny. People saying, well, hang on, what's going on here? We thought this was finished, et cetera, et cetera. And as well as the EU countries that signed off on it last week, the European Parliament has to do some work, and it's got a procedure to go through. And, you know, you've got MEPs down in Strasbourg and here in Brussels who'll be looking at this. And some of them may be uncomfortable with the, you know, the rights that that Northern Ireland is getting, even though the UK is not in the EU. Like, there were a few whispers about, oh, well, is this a precedent for other parts of Europe on the fringes, say, that are not really in, not really out, you know? And the Irish have had to argue, no, this is a unique situation because of the history in Northern Ireland, and that we don't want a land border, etc. But what the Irish position would be is that they don't want this conversation to restart and have these kind of more, you know, prying eyes, if you like, or more scrutiny of what was agreed, because then questions could be asked by MEPs about exactly what they're signing up to.
Now, our understanding around here was that if the UK didn't deliver or didn't make an effort, a successful effort to deliver, that the issue of trade was very much on the agenda, the possibility of a trade war. There are, the British economy is in rag order. They need a trade war, like they need a hole in the head. Mm. But if they can't confront the DUP successfully, and they are still holding out, how bad can this get for the British government?
It can get very bad. If this was to derail and unravel at this point, I think ultimately we would be looking at a trade war. Yes. And this is where, you know, this is where the EU, like, the fact that it didn't come up among EU leaders was a good sign last week. The EU leaders are happy to let it be dealt with at a kind of lower institutional level. But the moment, you know, it gets up to the level where you've got, like, the prime ministers of the big countries, like France and Germany, for example, getting involved, like we saw back, obviously, at the top of the height of the Brexit negotiations a few years back, well, then, you know, that's a sign of trouble. So the fact is that, you know, Germany in particular and France, and I think one of the big stories of Brexit over the last few years has been the hardening stance of Germany on this, particularly under the relatively new Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Obviously, Angela Merkel was in charge for most of the Brexit negotiations and indeed the Brexit vote. But he, in particular, did not have a good relationship with Boris Johnson. And really, you know, is in no mood to start any kind of renegotiation of this. He's got his own problems. He's got a coalition government he's trying to keep together. He's got, you know, Germany are really facing all these economic consequences of, as they try to get off Russian gas. There's a whole debate now about China and how far do you decouple from China. You know, they've big economic issues themselves, like no more than any other country in Europe, with the cost of living crisis and those political fragilities in Berlin with this three-party coalition. You know, there's no appetite to go any further, I would say, to assuage UK concerns. I think Europe felt they went as far as they can go. As I said there at the beginning, they did go really further than people would have thought. And there is certainly no mood to reopen this again if it is to unravel now because of the DUP.
Yeah, and I mean, just to clarify, the north of Ireland will be part of the single market, will have the advantage of the single market. There's no way that can happen without the European Court having some jurisdiction, correct?
Exactly, because people in Europe, you know, other EU countries will say, hang on, we can't just let other, you know, other jurisdictions have access to the single market. That's the deal. You're back to you can't have your cake and eat it. You're either in or you're out. And the beauty of this deal was that they're in and out. And the Irish diplomats, you know, won that argument very early on in the discussion. And it was almost like the UK, and particularly Boris Johnson, belatedly woke up to what they had signed up for. So there is willingness, and I think that the timing here is helping the Irish position because of this looming anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. Yes. It's kind of focusing minds and reminding people of the peace dividends, etc., and reminding them of what's at play here. And, you know, we've had various events here in Brussels, low level enough. We had, you know, Bertie Hearn was here a few weeks ago at an event. We had, you know, the Chris Heaton-Harris, Northern Ireland Secretary. He's an interesting person on this because he's an MEP himself. So he knows how Europe works. And that's one of the ironies about a lot of the Brexiteers. Like Boris Johnson being number one, he worked here as a journalist for many years.
He's fondly remembered.
Yes, and he grew up, he went to school at one point in Brussels. So, you know, you have these people, and it can be quite useful that somebody like Chris Heaton-Harris knows how Brussels works. So they've been here, they've been stressing this whole peace aspect of things. And that has given them, I think it's bought time for the process. But I think there are concerns about what's going to happen next month with this anniversary. Of course, you know, one of the problems for negotiators is the DUP don't particularly, they've said this on the record, don't particularly see Biden as a friend of Ireland anyway. So if they, yes. if you know, dangling this visit of a US president is not going to win them over. But it undoubtedly will get international pickup in a huge way now next month when this visit happens. And, you know, that, but the idea that this could drag on after it, that will not go down well here at all.
No, and just to finish about this particular subject, Rishi Sunak signed the accord with Ursula von der Leyen. It's Rishi has to deliver, doesn't he?
Absolutely. And he's done better than a lot of people expected by bringing his own party with him and effectively defying his predecessors, including Boris Johnson. But obviously the DUP, you know, government needs to happen in Northern Ireland. They're still refusing to do that. And that does have implications for this deal and how the EU looks at that. But as I say, the longer this goes on, you know, the worse it is. They need to get this wrapped up. The officials here feel like that, you know, we've got this big breakthrough. We did the whole photo shoot with Rishi and Ursula. It's time to move on. And any idea that this is going to resurface now will not go down well.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Let me ask you about the general mood across the European Union and the member states as things get tougher with the Russian-Ukraine conflict.
Yeah.
Interestingly, this week there was some movement by two significant politicians, Giorgia Meloni, the new prime minister in Italy, and Viktor Orban, also Orban had been sympathetic, should we say, to Vladimir Putin, had been, you know, not too keen to join any effort against Putin for his invasion of Ukraine. He has also been moving. Both of them are significant figures in terms of the unity of Europe, are they?
They certainly are. I mean, that's been one of the challenges of the EU, to keep your 27 countries together. And like what the EU has done in a nutshell since the war started a little over a year ago is introduce a series of sanctions. So over 10 packages of sanctions. But Hungary, as those sanctions, you know, the further you got down, the more difficult they were as you went along the sanctions route. It was easy enough to do the first set of sanctions. But as it got more tricky, then you heard some member states kind of raising their hand quietly saying, hang on, how is that going to affect us?
Yeah.
And Hungary was one of those countries that put a veto effectively back around the 6-7 sanctions package, was causing, you know, was raising questions. Eventually kind of got on board, but some concessions were made. So Hungary has always been the voice of skepticism about, you know, the EU's commitment to the war. In saying that, though, Orban, Viktor Orban, an increasingly autocratic leader who won re-election by landslide again last year, he is kind of, you know, he's got two impulses, because they're a member of the EU, but Hungary's also a member of NATO. And, you know,
yes.
So it's kind of in between. NATO, you know, was set up after World War II as a kind of an anti-Soviet, you know, a bulwark against the Soviet Union. And in one way, the Ukraine war has kind of given it back a purpose, some could say. I mean, I must make a judgment on that. I'm just saying, all of a sudden, NATO was faced with this Russian war in Ukraine. And so it was interesting this week in Hungary, the Hungarians were the only members of NATO, apart from Turkey, not to ratify Finland and Sweden's bid to join NATO. So they want to join NATO now, Finland and Sweden, particularly Finland, which shares this huge border with Russia. So incidentally, Eamon, it means that Ireland are losing people now. There used to be 6 EU member states that weren't members of NATO. After
yes.
Finland and Sweden join NATO, if they do, if this is ratified, there'll only be 4. So
yes.
The numbers are dwindling, you know, of the neutral EU countries. But anyway, Hungary had been kind of holding out on ratifying the Finnish and Swedish bid. So this week, Hungary did, just earlier on Monday, vote to ratify Finland's membership into NATO. But it's kind of copying Turkey in that it hasn't made a decision on Sweden. They were supposed to kind of go together. So you can see Orban kind of showing his muscle, or, you know, saying, look, we don't have to do this. Even though I think the feeling is that ultimately they will. So there's an awful lot of posturing a lot by Hungary, ultimately to come in line, but they want to show, you know, he wants to show he's the tough man.
Yes.
As long as possible, and manages to push it just as far as he can before ultimately kind of going in line before the EU. I mean, I've heard people say that here during the EU summits, he was here last week, for example, and there wasn't a word from Orban. That
yeah.
He, you know, he's in these meetings and he doesn't say much.
Well, there is a financial consideration, Suzanne, isn't there? For Hungary, there's money, and it's billions, that the Commission have not handed over because of the lack of democratic accountability, should we say.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very on the edge of being a dictator, if not over a particular edge.
Yeah.
And at some stage, will that pose a problem for the EU?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the most, like, it's fascinating what's happening between Hungary and the EU, and indeed a lot of the Eastern member states. Like, I was 4.5 years away from Brussels, and since I've come back in 2021, it was one of the big changes I saw, that a lot of these Eastern European countries, including Hungary, Orban has been around a long time, but he's become more right-wing, basically.
Yes.
And Poland as well. Like, and they're becoming, you know, rightfully, they're members of the EU. A country like Poland is a huge country. And they have got very dubious rule of law standards.
Yes.
Media freedom, big issue around that in Hungary.
Yes.
And the LGBT. This is a huge problem for the EU, because how can the EU, you know, lecture other countries, or, you know, even China or Russia, when it's actually got some members of its own that
yes.
Are not adhering to what we would say in Ireland, we would accept as common expectations in terms of
shared values. It would come under that headline, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Joe Biden is having this summit for democracy. It's something they pitched The first one's in 2021. Now, it's not going to get much traction, but as far as we're Hungary didn't get an invite to that. So you've got the situation that like the US is not even inviting a member of the EU. So it's a big problem for Europe. And but as you said there, yeah, they have it. It's very complex and it gets very technical, but effectively the EU has withheld money from Poland and Hungary as a kind of carrot and stick effect to try and get them to change. But you'd wonder, I was at something last year over in Eastern Europe and I really got the sense that that doesn't play well either, because then Orban or the Polish government kind of can use the EU as a bogeyman. Say, look, they're pressure, they're blackmailing us. They're pressurizing us to change our laws just to give us money.
Who has the biggest stick or carrot in this? I mean, it is a kind of shadow over the EU that you have a guy who's kind of not much of a Democrat. He is, as you point out, Suzanne, he's up in the ante all the time on press freedom gone, rule of law virtually gone. And is that sustainable?
Well, it kind of...
And what do the people in Brussels say?
It has to be sustainable unless, you know, there was talk after Brexit that could another country leave. And where that would possibly, I'm not saying it's going to happen, people were looking at places like Hungary, that it's no longer compatible, that it sees itself, you know, its values, etc., as you just mentioned, are not values of the EU, and the EU has standards to join the EU. But there's a really interesting, the EU, for you, when those Central and East European countries joined, a big bunch, in it, 10 of them joined in 2004, and there's a paradox at the heart of the EU. The EU is actually more powerful when it can exert influence on countries who are trying to get into the bloc. But once they're in, there's very little you can do.
Right.
So, you know, what can they do now? I mean, they're in, they're members, they've got votes, they deserve representation. But I think Poland is actually the bigger concern. Poland, and what's happened, because it's of its size, it's a huge country. It's one of the biggest countries in terms of population in the EU. You know, you can't ignore it. It's got a population nearly 40 million. So much, much bigger than Hungary. And now what's happened in the last year is that Poland has really occupied, and rightly so, a lot of people would say, the moral high ground, because it took a very strong view on the Russian invasion. It took in so many refugees. It's been leading the calls for help for Ukraine. And in fact, it was interesting last year, Ursula von der Leyen gives her big speech. It's called the State of the Union, a kind of a copycat of the American State of the Union speech, but she gives it every September in Strasbourg. And last year I was there and it was interesting. She kind of made some comments saying, we didn't listen to you enough, our Eastern members. You were right about Russia. So, you know, people, they have got a lot of kudos, rightly so. So it's very difficult for the EU to say to Poland, oh, listen, we're going to hold back your money because you have to change X, Y, and Z, when they're actually being to the forefront on the Russian thing. So now it is interesting. There are elections in Poland later this year. So that's going to be hugely interesting. And everyone's going to watch that. But and Donald Tusk, the former head of the European Council, a really interesting guy. He was involved with the Solidarity movement. He's very involved now in opposition politics. So that's going to be something interesting to watch at the end of the year.
Yes, and Poland have said that if Putin goes much further, they will go to war. Mm-hmm. And there is a question of Moldova, and it's very, very tricky. But the Poles are prepared to go to war with Ukraine, they say, but that buys them a bit of credit, perhaps.
Yes.
But the long-term compatibility, shall we say, between Hungary and the rest of the EU and Poland and the rest of the EU, it is a problem, isn't it, for the EU? Because, I mean, if you go back to Giorgia Meloni and Italy now, Italy is a huge country. It has massive problems, the economics and also geographically with the immigration issue. That's another country that isn't exactly sharing European values, or might not in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, her election was greeted with much trepidation here in Brussels. You remember she took over from Mario Draghi, Super Mario, who was former head of the ECB, who was very well respected here. And there were a lot of fears. Now, she's, again, when she comes to these EU summits, has been, you know, relatively low key. And again, it comes down to money, Eamon, because the Italian economy is so big and has been so, well, troubled in some ways for a long time, that when the EU announced its big recovery fund back during the height of the COVID pandemic, Italy was standing to receive a huge amount of money. So it kind of, and but there are conditions to that.
Yes.
So she knows that, her population, her citizens know that, they want to get the EU money, and so she's not going to jeopardize that.
Right. Good. So money is the big carrot.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the same with us when, well, you're probably too young to remember, when Albert Reynolds was Taoiseach waving.
No, I do remember. I do remember.
Waving a cheque in Edinburgh.
Yeah. You see, it's interesting the way that we were once those, you know, the more of a recipient of EU money. So, you know, she knows that, but there is, I mean, she's very right wing. And some of her, I mean, again, she's got a coalition, which is interesting as well, because it always changes things. But what her big issue, what she's fighting on now, what I think her focus is the migration issue.
Yes. And well, they're very exposed to that, aren't they?
They are. And to be fair, there is some sympathy for that because, I mean, it's a topic for a whole other day. The EU's migration policy is so fragmented. And you've got the countries at the south, usually, like Greece and Italy, who receive most migrants arriving by boat, these awful images we see in the sea.
Yes.
And then you've got countries up north, like the Netherlands and Germany, who are kind of get a lot of migrants who then travel up to those countries for work. But they're saying there's always a constant tension because they're saying that under this EU rule, the Dublin Agreement, actually, the migrants are supposed to stay in the first country they arrive and claim asylum. And they're saying Italy and Greece are not holding up their side of the bargain. But to be fair to Italy and Greece, they're getting many, many more migrants than anyone else. So, you know, their argument would be, well, there should be better burden sharing. We should share around. So, but the awful tragedy that happened last month with more migrant deaths, I mean, her government came under huge criticism about that boating tragedy, about how, you know, when did the authorities know, should they have gone out quicker to try and save these people who died in these horrific circumstances? And she was even getting backlash, a lot of backlash within Italy too. So it is by far the dominant issue for Italy at the moment is migration. But she's benefiting, I think, a little bit. Now, I'm exaggerating a bit, but the EU as a whole has moved a little bit to the right on migration.
So right.
When she's at the meeting saying it's not, you know, we have to toughen up on people smugglers and we have to toughen up, you know, and not encourage people to come, she's probably got more support from that than she would have back in 2015 when Angela Merkel was opening Germany.
Yes.
Quite rightly, in my view, but you know, to migrants, the thing has shifted now. So she's probably not as isolated as she may have been if this was happening maybe 5 years ago, I'd say.
Right. Just want to ask you a final question, Suzanne, about the Northern Ireland Protocol and the patience the EU are likely to have with the UK if Sunak does not get it sorted. What are we talking about time-wise?
Well, I think there's a few things. One of the things that it unlocked was the EU's involvement in the Horizon Research Programme. That's huge for universities. And there was also a kind of a memorandum of understanding on the whole financial services, which is complex but important for the City of London. So those two things, I think, could be first to be in the firing line.
Right.
They've been kind of put back on track. But then it would take a while. I think, I don't think we're looking, I mean, I'm not, one thing is that, you know, it would take maybe, I mean, my guess would be, you know, we're nearing the summer, you know, by the time this would really fall apart, it'll be next autumn.
Right.
But then we're getting into, it's only, you know, less than a year to the European Parliament elections and a new commission.
Yes.
So it remains to be seen, would they do anything radical before that?
Right.
So, look, it's still, I don't want to be alarmist. It's still in everyone's interest to get this relationship back on track. But if it comes to it, I do not think that the big countries like Germany and France, and ultimately, I mean, they're the ones who really are going to, you know, like everything here, to be honest, what they think matters. And they're happy to let it go now, but any suggestion to give them further concessions, it's just not going to happen. And I think they'd be prepared to walk away from the deal.
Okay, Suzanne, I'm very grateful to you for joining us. I understand Suzanne Lynch is Chief Brussels Correspondent for Politico and the host of EU Confidential, a very good podcast. That's in direct competition with us. Thank you very much, Suzanne.
Thanks, great to join you.
And we're grateful to Suzanne, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.